Good evening. You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman, the audio mirror of the Gallatin Valley, 95.9 on your FM dial, kgvm.org online. It's time tonight for the local musician spotlight. I'm your host, Bob Wall, and I've got a special program for you tonight. We're not going to have a kind of the mix of performance and interview that we often do for the spotlight. I've got an interview here that we recorded with some artists that have an event coming up here in a couple days, so please kick back and enjoy. Hello, we are in the KGVM studios today with a group that's, I've seen all of you in a lot of different configurations over the years here in Bozeman, longtime members of the Bozeman music scene, and but you're all three getting together here for some shows coming up here at the filling station. So I wonder if maybe we'll start out about talking about those. So what and when and how, what's that going to look like?
I'm Jenny Fleming, and I'm going to be performing two concerts on September 27th at the filling station. The first one's at 7 p.m., the second one's at 9 p.m., and I'm performing with pianist Eric Funk and bassist John Sanders.
All right. Yeah, if you guys want to introduce yourselves. And
I'm Eric Funk, sitting opposite Jenny here.
I'm John.
All right, so I was trying to think. I think the last time I saw Jenny and Eric, you were playing together at Tune Up for a Bossa Nova show. And that's been a little while ago, I guess.
Right.
A little over a year ago, I think.
Right. And that was with a band, with a full band, with the drummer and bass. And
yeah. That was in response to the passing of Astrid Gilberto.
Yeah.
She died in May, I think, and we did that show in June. Does that sound right?
I think that's right, yeah. And it's a fun memory for me because I got there a little early, and the two bartender women said, you know, we just want to tell you, don't feel bad if you don't have any kind of a crowd, because Wednesday nights people tend to not come out. And I said, well, I said, I don't mean to sound braggadocious, but if you need to go to the bathroom, I would do it soon, because we're going to get a pretty good-sized crowd. And we did.
It was a pretty full house that night.
It was really fun. It was a great time. Always fun to play with Jenny.
Yeah. So how did the, what are you thinking for the shows at the filling station? What kind of a program?
Well, so when Eric and I are preparing for different performances here and there, and we've performed at just about every venue in town, and we've known each other for almost 30 years. So it's run the gamut. Weddings, funerals, fundraisers, I mean, you name it, we've played it. And so when we're preparing for those, he often comes over to my house. And if Johnny's available, he'll come out and play with us just for fun. And after years of doing that, we thought, well, why don't the three of us just bring this living room music out into the public. And, you know, over the past several years, I've kind of toned down my performances. I don't do it very often anymore for lots of reasons, but when an opportunity comes up where I really love the people that I'm going to play with, I love the music that we're going to play, then it's sort of an opportunity that I can't say no to. There's lots of opportunities I can say no to, but this is one that I'll never pass it up. Spending time with people that I love, doing things that, we're all sort of bringing our best to the table. So this filler show, the idea for the filler show came up years ago, and I just never had any musicians that I was working with that were as excited about it as me until I told Eric about it. And the idea was to turn the filler and all of the vibe, what is the filler, with, you know, the dusty beer cans and the mobile Pegasus and the sticky floors and, you know, the whole nine yards, but kind of stick a jazz club, sort of an elegant jazz club, in the middle of this scene. So bringing in a 6-foot grand to put on the stage, which, by the way, when we decided to do this, that's the first thing I did was I called Bill at the Fill Air and I said, can your stage hold a 6-foot grand? And he said, yes, because it's been rebuilt recently. And cocktail tables with white linens and candles. And, you know, it's still in the envelope of the Fill Air, which is a really beloved bar room for all of us that have been here for so long.
Yeah.
But the format of the show is like a jazz club, where it's a 1-hour concert, and then we clear the room and fill it up again and do a 1-hour concert.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a... I was trying to think. I saw a couple of shows there in the past year. This summer, I think somebody did one where there were people seated, and it wasn't cocktail tables with linens. It was still the filler, but it was kind of a different experience. I've been to a lot of shows there, and that's not kind of the norm. But it's pretty intriguing to think of kind of reimagining it as a jazz club, because it's, as you said, it's got a lot of atmosphere. And, I mean, it's probably my favorite place in town to see music, and has been for quite a while. But yeah, it's an intriguing idea. I think I like the sound in there a lot, so I think that'll be a good place to do something like that.
I think what was attractive to me is there's an honesty in that atmosphere that is hard to find, especially in the newer venues where it's very slicked up and clean and, you know, state of the art, everything. I hadn't thought of that. That's true. There's an authenticity that kind of goes away. It might be convenient to have built-in sound and a great sound guy and blah, blah, blah. And by the way, they do.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like at the Ellen or the Rialto or... It's a different environment.
Well, and along with that honesty, it kind of includes the fact that most musics are drawn from a pretty rough edge. And I think it gets airbrushed and polished up and made really polite, when in fact, a lot of times the energy that's driving it is much more elemental. And I think you can lose that in a slick space, because the audience shows that they feel like they need to dress a certain way and behave a certain way. And if you look at the roots of jazz, for example, it's a much more angry art.
Yeah.
You know, it's people who've been disenfranchised. They don't have a good social contract. And so they, in the case of rap in the early days, for example, the idea was to take what was out there in the marketplace, repackage it, and throw it back in the face of the public. You know, and I think that's the reason, for example, something like punk arose with such strength, because rock and roll had gotten so nice.
Yeah.
And so polite that it didn't have any earthiness left in it. So one of the things that I love about this particular show is the repertoire that Jenny has chosen isn't traditional repertoire. It's nothing we've done before. I'm playing very differently than I usually play. I've been working really hard to kind of get into the Bruce Hornsby style of playing, just laying down the chords and connecting them very sparsely to give her tremendous room to fly over the top. And John and I, because I really like John as a human being, so it's really fun to play music with him as well, because that honesty is also at play there.
Yeah.
We can create a framework for Jenny on these songs that no one's ever heard these songs done this way before, and it's exquisite. But we're real thin, and then there are some places where I'll solo and go into my usual bag of tricks. But, you know, for the most part, it's a completely different sound than we've ever achieved before, and it's really fun. You know, it's a very collaborative gig.
Nice. That was interesting thinking about that. Like, I have this notion, I guess, and I think a lot of people do too, about jazz. Like, the pointing out that it was not polished music, because I think now we have this kind of perception that it's, oddly enough, it seems like some people think that it's kind of this highbrow music, you know, and it's not music of the people and by the people and for the people, which... Yeah, like you said, that is totally the opposite of it. It's
genesis, right?
Absolutely. And it, you know, kind of gave rise to rock and roll, which is more repetitious and more simplified. But if you go back to early jazz blues, that's just about as basic as you can get. Some of that stuff was a one chord blues change. I mean, you just played the same chord and just told the truth. And then it turned to two chords. But that said, I think there's a hierarchy in the music industry, and there are people that I refer to as jazz Nazis because they're very arrogant about what is jazz and what is not jazz and what they will listen to and what they will not listen to. And from my perspective, you know, playing all styles, I think it's pretty dangerous to say this is this style and this is that style when they're all sort of polystylistic admixture forms.
Yeah.
And to be critical of some form because, well, it's not, you know, hitting the squares that we think should be. I mean, that's not jazz. Right. You know, I don't want to play with people who have that attitude because there's a certain pretentiousness that can come with that.
Right.
That said, you know, when I was playing a lot of gigs with Kelly Roberti, the distance between what we were doing as a jazz duo and what I do as a contemporary classical composer is no distance at all. I mean, there are things that I was playing on the piano that just are so outside. I mean, the priorities, you know, of musics are different, and jazz is a pattern development art form, like classical music. And it is a little heady. It can be a little heady, but it doesn't exclude the soul and the heart.
Right.
And that's when it gets kind of bizarre, you know, where you start feeling like, as soon as you say jazz, people, I don't like. That's, I think, what has been working so well for me with my TV show, 11th and Grant, is that people will say, oh, it's a jazz, I don't like jazz. And then they'll go, but I like this.
Yeah.
And it's because you're making it available to them, and it's honest, and we're all just telling the truth through whatever medium, and I draw on everything I've got when I'm playing behind this woman, and John and I have locked it down. I love playing with this guy, and I play with a lot of bass players, but there's something that we achieve that I can't do with a different guy. I mean, this is unique.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I think, what was so attractive to me about this configuration of musicians is that, obviously, Johnny and I have been in a relationship for 12 years now. Have a love and a respect for each other that I simply don't have with anyone else on the planet. And Eric and I go back 30 years. He's been a champion of me and every other young musician in this town. I mean, it's not a unique story that I have about Eric. But when you have that kind of trust, you're able to bring stuff to the table that I wouldn't necessarily bring to, say, you know, like a corporate band where you really are there for the paycheck.
Yeah.
And those kinds of jobs exist. But this was the goal in this was so different. And in fact, the venue and kind of bringing out the authenticity of the venue and even the photo shoot that I did with our friend Dan Bradner was the first photo shoot where I didn't have makeup on or jewelry. I was wearing the t-shirt on for 3 days by the time I showed up to the, you know, like it was, there was an honesty to that. I just wanted it to look like me. I said, I'm 50. I want to look like I'm 50. I don't want this slick. Yeah. And honestly, you know, the albums that I've put out in the past have been pretty slick. They were mixed and mastered in Nashville, for Lord's sake. I mean, that's a certain sound.
Yeah.
The covers were photoshopped within an inch of their lives. And I'm looking for something different now. I'm sure it's the time in my life, partly. But as that relates to the music, I think this is the conversation that Eric and I have had off and on for 30 years, that I learned to sing by listening to the radio. People like Whitney Houston and Mariah Carey and Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder and, you know, those were the people that taught me how to sing. But I also grew up a classical pianist. So there's a discipline around this creative endeavor that has been in place since I was tiny. So when I started studying jazz, I approached it the same way. I didn't know another way of approaching it. And so the things that make me the musician that I am are pretty varied. A long classical history, a love of pop and rock music, and some of my most important mentors were jazz musicians, Kathy Honaker and Ralph Sappington, that I continue to talk about over and over. And so the music that I brought to the table for the three of us sort of reflects that. Def Leppard was a really important band for me when I was 12. You know, and those formative experiences you have when you're young and you fall in love with music for the first time, that's when you make the decision to pursue this profession. Because if you were an adult and you had your wits about you, you'd never choose this on purpose, right?
Passion driven.
Right. Yeah. That's when you make the decision. So we're doing a Def Leppard tune, but in a jazz ballad style. What I want is for people to be like, why do I know these lyrics?
Yeah.
There's something familiar about these lyrics, or the same thing with the Guns N' Roses song, or the same thing with a Cure song. And then there's the jazz standards, you know, there's stuff that people will recognize. And I obviously have a long love of bossa nova music, so there's some of that in there too. But asking these guys to just bring their honest selves to the table is the only thing that's going to make that collaboration work. It can't be just jazz musicians. It wouldn't come out right.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, and jazz, you know, another thing about when people usually hear that word, you're making a poem about the poem. And so the jazz head has been written in such a way that it's rife with material that's dying to be developed. And in this particular gig, I'm not really giving you 10% of the head and 80% of my feelings about it and how I want to develop it architectonically or emotionally, but rather just playing the song, because what Jenny has chosen to sing, the lyrics are very poignant. And I think a lot of people are going to go, I didn't even realize that's what they were saying in that song. Because Jenny is a great person to carry and sell a lyric and really bring it forward. And I think that's going to be very apparent when you're in this concert. You know, if you're able to attend, we'd love to see you. But what's going down is that Jenny's going to be singing things that she always does from the heart and the mind in such a way that they're going to go like, whoa. And be touched by these things in a completely different framework. We're delivering it, we're repackaging it and giving it to very nude. I mean, it's very direct. An acoustic piano, acoustic double bass, and voice.
Yeah.
And boy, it doesn't get much more bare than that.
I think that thing that you're describing happens all the time. And this has happened to Johnny and I several times, where people say, we really want this song for our first dance at our wedding, or we want this song sung at the wedding ceremony. And I'm like, have you read the lyrics to Ave Maria, for example, which is so inappropriate for a union of souls? It's a song about a mother whose son is being crucified. You know, like, just... But I think people hear the whole package often, especially in rock and pop, and they fall in love with the ambiance of the song, not knowing what it's about. So when we strip away all that stuff and repackage it, as you're saying, the listener gets to hear it again for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hello.
That's I love that. And, you know, I'm not sure. It seems like a lot of the instances I've heard of people doing things like that, like reinterpreting, especially pop and rock songs, have been in the jazz context, like John Scofield. You know, he does some of that. Sometimes I'm like, not really sure. I look at the track listing. It's like, oh, I must know that song. And then you listen to it, I'm like, is it? Yeah. I guess that's the song I was thinking of, but you know, yeah. But I just that opportunity, like you said, to make people like actually re-experience it and probably get a lot more out of it in that process. It's like, oh, I didn't really think about the lyrics because they were buried in this mix of loud guitars and loud drums and loud bass and stuff. And so now the lyrics are out front and center, and I'm familiar with them, but I'm confronting them in a pretty different way. It's like, I think that that's just a lot of fun. And so.
Agreed. That happens a lot in jazz too. I had a young student one time come to her lesson. This was years ago. And she was learning Don't Get Around Much Anymore. Do you know that song?
Yeah.
And so I taught it to her, this happy-go-lucky medium swing up tune. And she says, why don't the lyrics match the music? Seriously, like 10 years old. And I thought, I don't know. And so just for fun, just to sort of prove to her that everything in jazz is negotiable, I changed it all to a really slow minor jazz ballad. And at the end of her lesson, I was like, note to self, that was super cool. And I put it on an album. I can't remember which one, but Don't Get Around Much as a really slow, it turns into a very tragic, like, I don't know, maybe the person becomes agoraphobic or doesn't want to leave their house, that kind of heartbreak. And I think that happens a lot.
Yeah.
And you flip through the fake book and you can find tons of songs that, you know, those things don't match up. So that, for me, that's fun, writing in that way, arranging songs to just slowing down the lyrics, not even changing the melody. Or actually, Eric and I have done a slow version of Tea for Two for several years, that just slowing it down, not changing a word or a melody note or a chord, turns it into a different song altogether.
And oftentimes the original tune was driven by the lyrics, and then somebody said, let's do it up tempo. And that's the one that becomes popular because people want to dance,
right?
And they want the groove pocket. Right. And so they forget those words. You can't sing that with, I mean, it's almost farcical when you think about it. Missed the Saturday dance, heard they crowded the floor, awfully different.
Couldn't
without
bear
you.
It without you. Yeah.
Don't get around much anymore.
They would have asked me about you.
Oh yeah.
I know what that feels like.
Yeah. But it is when it's lyric driven like this show, it's really fun. And it's not a whole night of ballads. I mean, it really is. We've got a real nice mixed tempo fare.
Yeah.
But no matter what happens.
I do love the ballads.
Well, and they're fun to play. You know, I do too. I can do a whole night of them, a whole night of Latin or a whole night of ballads. I mean, it's a joy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you said that you've kind of don't perform out much anymore. Do you think that that's kind of continue to be the case? You'll do kind of things like this.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think I finally just got to a place where I've learned about myself that every performance will always be personal. Always. I'm not the kind of musician that can do something just because it's business. It's never going to be business. And when I have tried to push myself to just think of it as a job and I'm just going to collect a paycheck, there's nothing redeeming about it. First of all, there's not enough money to make that okay. With me, I sort of have a similar attitude about teaching. Teaching is really rewarding. It's also really frustrating when you see how much potential a kid has and they decide not to pursue it.
Yeah.
Well, it's not my child. I can't make them do anything. And all I can do is try to inspire them each week to keep going. But that's not how it always turns out. But when it comes to my music, I do have the control to do the concerts that I really love, play with the people that I love, almost in a way. And I'm sure you've heard this before, that musicians kind of go through this. You fall in love with music as a young person, and then you start pursuing it, and all you want to do is tour and record. And, you know, you might have some sort of misguided ideas about gaining some recognition, or, you know, making a name for yourself, or making a lot of money or whatever. And pretty soon that starts to fade, and all you want to do is recapture the love that you had as a kid. That's the phase I'm in now, and I haven't figured out how to do it all the time every day and recapture the love. So I'm gonna do the concerts where I do feel in love again with the music, and I'm gonna forego the other ones.
Concerts as art instead of as performance.
Right.
I think about this sometimes, just this conundrum about music. And I suppose it's maybe a little bit the same for maybe dance. I don't think it's maybe as much in visual arts, but just people who want to do this art and try to be professional at it. It's like you get pulled into this thing that's not the art, it's the performance. And I don't think those two things are, they have some points where they rub up against each other, but it seems like they get pulled, you know, you get pulled apart. If you're doing the performance thing, it makes it kind of hard to sometimes, I think, do art. And maybe this is the way I think of it. Maybe this is not the way that a lot of people think of what art is, but, you know, just that tension between being a professional musician, which in my mind is not necessarily being an artist, it's being a performer. And that pull of performance, like separating you from being able to do maybe what you would think more of as pure art.
I'm sure that there's crossover, you know, and every person is different, but it's kind of like music and the music industry are mutually exclusive. Like they don't have a whole hell of a lot to do with each other.
Well, there's the business of things and the art of things.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And I think that there are people that can do both. I just happen to not be one of them. And in fact, I don't know that I was ever in love with performing. That was not me.
Well, I think there's a general misunderstanding with the public I'll just stay with musicians, that they're extroverted people, and they aren't. They're introverts who've manufactured an extrovert piece. John's a great example of that.
I'm gonna
sort of segue into John, because he has an album that came out that I listened to that is very much who John is, and it sort of represents what we're talking around, which has to do with, we have this thing and we want to give it to you. Yeah. We want to give it away, and it's different. And I think we mix art and entertainment. Art is something that changes you, and our objective is to change you. Entertainment is more like driving through a drive-through hamburger. It's fun. It doesn't really change you. You don't have to know anything coming in, and you're not going to be much different when you go out. Mm-hmm. When you admix the two things together, you get a pretty powerful thing. And from my perspective, like with this concert, we're keeping the focus on the intimacy and the poignant, direct gift that we're giving. We really are doing this. And John, as in this interview, tends to be in the background and kind of hold down the fort. Yep. And yet he's irreplaceable, you know? And so the fun of playing with John is that he's underspoken, but when he does say something, it's really important. He doesn't have a lot of, you know, he's not verbose, but you know, and I think one of the things, when I wrote a really positive response to his album, and I think it probably embarrassed him a little bit, because I was going after how it wasn't self-annihilating, but it was self-revealing to a level that I was really surprised by. And I loved the fact that he was willing to not make it something that people would go out and buy and want to dance to. This is like a George Harrison record, where you listen to it and each tune takes you to a place, and you have to be willing to go there, and you have to let go of everything else and say, I'm going to let this thing take me. And that's kind of where we are. And I don't know. Did I say too much, John?
No, it's very nice.
I'm definitely so guilty of this, and it annoys me about myself. I think John's album is, it's an album that you have to just sit down and listen to. And I don't do that, and I mean hardly ever anymore. It's just like, you know, I've got this stack of music, it's always coming in, there's always things I want to check out, and I've got all of these other things to do. So it's just kind of, you know, you put it on and then you do other things and you don't sit there and listen to it. And some music works fine that way, you know, but a lot of music doesn't. And I think that album in particular, it's like, no, you really, if you're going to get the things that you can get out of it, you have to work at it. It's not just a passive thing. It's, you have to engage with it. And,
What I think is so special about that album is that Johnny is, trusting that his audience is more intelligent than most albums will give an audience credit for.
True.
Well, and if you're trying to sell it, you know, if you're into the business of, right, of the music industry, you know what's going to sell. I know what's going to sell. You know, if I want to write a jingle, I know how to write a jingle that you can't get out of your mind and just drive you completely insane. I can build earworms. But, you know, I think groove pockets are a big deal, you know. But I think when somebody is really willing to share something with you, you have to be willing. You have to be vulnerable and say, I'm here to listen, and I'm not going to interrupt. You know, I used to tell my students when I was teaching at Montana State, put on something you want somebody to listen to, and watch your watch, your second hand, or put on a timer and see how many seconds it is before they either start talking or pick up something else or do something else.
Yeah.
Because music has turned into wallpaper. Yeah. You know, it's part of the ambience of the space. And even people who are driving in their car, they have no idea why they're listening to what they're listening to.
Right.
You know, it's what they're listening to. It's just sort of a general, and I understand it. It's not a criticism. It's just a thing. But I think there is an opportunity with art to have your whole compass shifted back to north.
And yeah,
that's what we're thinking about with this particular gig, is we're bringing it in earnest. We're going to have a blast. I mean, it's not some serious, you know, it's dressed in black or something.
Yeah, in this area have heard me sing for a long time. It's not like I'm some super avant-garde. I like to sing melodies. You know, so. And same with Eric. They've heard Eric play a bunch. And Johnny and lots of bands around town. Like, we're all pretty in the pocket, diatonic. You know, like, it's not going to be...
It's not going to be John Cage or anything.
No. And yet, we're going to do our best to tell the truth when we're up there.
It's going to be a really interesting, very, very memorable gig. It's not going to be just another gig that you forget about. It's one of those ones where you keep thinking back on it. You know how you've had those conversations with somebody where you go like, and you try to recapture it and you can't?
Yeah.
You know, where something happens and you're not really sure what it is, but it's everything, there's a synergistic principle, you know, more than the sum of its parts, that comes to bear when there's magic afoot. And we're bringing the setup, and if the audience that comes is willing to let go and let it happen, it's one of those things that, it's just going to be memorable. You're not going to forget this one. Yeah. And part of it is Jenny's brilliant idea about the filler. Say, let's take this to an honest space.
Yeah.
And let's tell the truth there.
Well, I remember having a conversation with you. I think we were rehearsing for something else at your house. And I said, how many times I've been in a band where I've suggested something or other, like, oh, we should do this to the environment, or... You know, what's happening with the lights? And so many times, not every time, but so many times I've been made to feel like that's not your concern. The music is your, and not even just the music, your part as the singer, that's your concern. And why are you even bothering with all this other stuff? I remember doing recitals and buying flowers from the florist, which, you know, costs money. And because there is something important to me about doing everything I can to make the whole experience, what it looks like, what it feels like, what it smells like, what and certainly what it sounds like. And the audience would leave a concert and they probably couldn't name more than two songs that you sang, but they'll remember how they felt. And the same when you come to my house for dinner, that you felt special or you felt thought of or considered, you know, if you have allergies or whatever, you know, like that is what is important to me. And so I remember saying to you at that rehearsal, I'm done apologizing for all of those things being important to me. And here's my idea about the filler. And Eric said, that's a great idea. Let's do that.
Well, and I think in times like this, when the world is so polarized, authenticity is really important. You can kind of leave everything at the door. And you leave your ego at the door, and there's no expectation except just to come in and be available. And, you know, I was thinking as we were talking about some guy just driving into town and saying, I'll go over to the filler. Now, they have a whole expectation. It's like walking into a French restaurant and wanting a hamburger.
Yeah.
And it's you know, but I think, you know, I think that person can even be changed because the collective energy is going to be what it is.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be, you know, people doing the worm on the floor. You know, it's going to be a whole different...
Oh, no one would do the worm on the floor at the filler, would they?
You would think not, but it turns out, yes. And I'm not one of those people because I'm, you know, I'm not super concerned about germs and stuff, but there's a point where you go, yeah, that's probably not a very well-advised idea.
That brings up another funny thing. One of my kids said, are you going to put a 6-foot grand piano in the filler? Will it fit? And I said, there are a lot of 6-foot people in the building.
Yeah.
A 6-foot grand isn't that much bigger than a 6-foot person.
Funny.
And if they were laying on the floor, which is probably ill-advised, but if they were laying on the floor, they wouldn't be any longer than that piano.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that big of an instrument. It just sounds big.
Right.
You
know? The grand.
Yeah, the grand piano. But no, it's going to be an amazing, memorable, and for us too, because we're going to walk away from this concert with an aftertaste that is a bouquet. I mean, it's going to really have, and that happens a lot when I do stuff with Jenny. I always feel like because of the deep affection we have and respect we have for one another, and just the fact that she said, I want to do this at the filler and I'm going to get a grand piano. She knows that I hate electric pianos to the extent that I used to drive to gigs with a U-Haul trailer with a piano in it and a tuning hammer and take the piano, you know, out between Schnee's and the Baxter on a dolly and take it up the elevator and tune it and play it because I can't make music on an electric piano. Others can. I can't. And they can say, oh, they're weighted keys. Don't even start talking to me about it. They eat your aesthetic. Yeah. But the thing is it was a love gift from Jenny to say, I'm going to get a piano for this gig because she knows that then I'm in my zone and I'm all there and I can support her completely.
Yeah.
And then John is playing a stand-up bass, an acoustic bass. And it's flesh on gut, you know. It's just so personal. This is a tactile gig.
Yeah.
And even though Jenny's mic'd, she feels like she's not. She could be whispering these lyrics to you.
Yeah. I think when you were talking about that, it occurred to me how funny it is that, you know, people, when you're going to the shows, you think about the audience, their perception and the energy that they get and the energy that they give. But a lot of times I don't think people really think about what's going on up on the stage and the fact that the musicians are also, you know, there's all of this stuff that they're getting out of the gig too. And it's not, you know, it's not just them up there projecting, you know, you're not just up there forcing this out into the audience. It's like, it's going both ways. And just the fact that you get to experience this thing, that's going to be very different too. Like, you know, the stage at the filler is it's different, you know. It's just, it's, you know, that those layers of dust and atmosphere there. And so the fact that you can, you know, you'll be able to get this experience that's pretty significantly different from playing at Tune Up or, you know, the Elm or whatever.
And that said, you know, when the opera did Rent and La Boheme side by side, scene to scene, you know, suddenly, you know, he's singing Che Gelli da Manina, you know, Your Tiny Hand is Frozen, and it's just, it's in Italian for crying out loud, and the supertitles are up above the neon sign. And the audience was moved. And when we play, you know, when we played Like at Planck, Jenny and I, and you see somebody in the audience get deeply moved, we take that fuels us.
Yeah.
You say, oh, you're moved? Now we're really going to move you. It changes what I do in terms of touch and voicing. And we just go after the feeling. If you want feeling, we're going to give you feeling. If you want energy, we'll give you energy. So it definitely is a cross-fueling setup. And I'm sure that's true for John, too. You know what? As a bassist, he hasn't memorized a line. You know, he's playing, he's responding to me. We're in duo as an engine room, you know, lifting Jenny's voice into the air. Want to add anything to that?
Do you
want to
say something, or do you just want to nod? No.
Sorry, I don't have anything to say at this juncture.
We're just teasing you.
Well, yeah, I haven't figured out if I could weasel out of it. When John sent me the thing, said you guys were doing that show, I was like, yes. Then I went and looked at my calendar. I think I am doing sound for a show upstairs that night. So because I was like, oh, so I'm still contemplating whether I can draft someone else to do it, because I think it will be a pretty memorable show, you know, in so many dimensions.
And the cool thing is, we're doing two. It's kind of like Yoshi's in San Francisco, you know, where we do a show, then we clear the house.
Yeah,
just they did the same thing with the opera, and then a whole different crowd comes in for the next show. And so maybe you can make one of them.
Yeah, maybe I can manage to.
Because the first one's early. What's
it's like seven or something. Yeah, we almost never see places doing shows like that here anymore, and I don't know if they do in bigger places or not still.
Well, I think that's probably a standard format for most jazz clubs anyway.
Is it still? Yeah.
Yeah, because
it's become more common.
Audiences are there to listen. And those kinds of shows are shorter.
Yeah.
You know, you go to a bar, or when we used to play bars, it would be 9 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
They're not there to pay attention to every word that's coming out of your mouth.
They're there to party. You know, it's a different thing. But when you go to a concert, for example, you know, we try to time them out about an hour to an hour and a half, and that's getting a little long with an intermission. But if you're going to do a non-stopper, you kind of want to knock it down in an hour, because people's attention span plus respect for how much they can accept, because you're loading a lot of information in, and there's not a lot of downtime between tunes, you know, in a more formal performance like this is. I think it's going to be very unique and very wonderful. That's our intention.
I hope you can make it. I'm pretty strongly motivated to figure out a way to. It's just I think I was doing something the night they did the opera there too, and I was kicking myself, because it looked like that would have been a very interesting and I mean I've been in this situation with jazz, and I'm finally like getting to the point where I don't feel like it's kind of this weird listener imposter syndrome, and I'm still this way with classical music. It's like I just have this feeling that it's a music that you have to be more committed to listening to, like put more into, and I don't have the background, so I feel like, you know, I don't know that I'm appreciating things as much as I should, which is a stupid idea. It's like, if you like it, if it sounds good to you, and if you listen, you'll get things out of it, and maybe they're not the things that the scholars tell you you should have gotten out of it, but that doesn't matter. But you know, I still have that kind of that feeling about classical music, like I don't understand enough about it. I don't have a background in it to be able to do it justice to listen to it, it's ridiculous.
I think that a lot of people feel that way, because jazz and classical are so academic. Like, you go to music school, that's typically what you're going to study.
Right.
But the what's so infuriating about that for me is that those ideas are being perpetuated by people in jazz and in classical. And for someone who grew up a classical pianist and then kind of got into the jazz world later when I was 16, 17, so I felt like I had one foot in each camp. When I finally was going to school, it was crazy to me to see my professors behaving like this. Like, it's rampant. And they sort of talk about each other behind each other's backs. But because I was in both worlds, I was hearing both of it.
Yeah.
Even in one tiny school, I would hear it from the professors. So, you know, when you see behind the curtain, you're like, oh, none of this holds water. Right. None of it.
And it's changed now for a number of reasons. And for example, the School of Music at Montana State is full of such young energy and such vibrant personalities that elitism isn't at play anymore. And I think a lot of the big performance organizations can't afford the snobbery that goes with it, because it becomes a private club. And even when I was conducting the Helena Symphony all those years, I told my musicians, I said, you cannot stay backstage and hang out and talk to each other. Put your instrument in your case, go out into the lobby, find somebody that you've never seen before, introduce yourself and welcome them. This may be their first symphony concert.
Yeah.
And we want to make it really fun. And, you know, and I love how honest you were with that perception, because I think a lot of people feel that way but wouldn't want to say it out loud. But, you know, I think the fact that you also said, but you can be available, and really, with real honest music, and this isn't that complicated of a gig. I mean, this isn't a heady, heavy, sophisticated, cerebral gig at all. This is a real heart gig, soul gig. But even with that, even if we were doing some more complicated stuff, I think if you're available for it, and the artists that are bringing it to you are as forthcoming as we are individually and collectively, that it's really hard to not have it have impact. You have to have all your defenses up. I'm not listening to this.
Right. You have to be determined to block it out.
Yeah. But that's a really good point. And I think that's starting to drift away. And I think part of it, you know, with schools like the Berklee School of Jazz and some of these other schools that are trying to break down these artificial boundaries and get rid of that fourth wall and to make the audience aware of the fact that, boy, do we rely on their energy. We feel everything they feel, and it doesn't matter if it's one person or 2,000 or 20,000. You feel the energy in it. It's the wave that you're riding, and you're still going to, you have to be so accountable for being as direct and sincere as you possibly can be. And it takes a lot of guts to be that vulnerable on stage.
Yeah.
But when you're with people that you really trust, there's nothing that, we're going to hold each other. That's what we do.
That is the difference for me. When you're with people that you really trust, then the performance is probably going to be great, just because of that element. The audience, for me, honestly, has to be considered last. If I'm considering the audience when I'm writing a show, or, you know, even just coming up with the material, like, oh, I really should do an uptune here, because what if I put them all to sleep? And, you know, like, I have to stop thinking about that. It's only an hour. If you can't stay awake for an hour, then maybe this is not the show for you.
This is not your thing.
But yes, if the trust is there, then I know it's going to be impactful. I remember being on tour with the trio years and years ago, and we showed up to a gig where they did not know we were coming. It was like a big tour that they hire you for like 20 concerts or whatever. And it was on the High Line, so you just drive across the High Line and hit every tiny, tiny town. And we showed up in a town, and the lady said, I'm sorry, what's your name? Like, had zero idea we were coming. Four people came to the show. There's three of us in the band and four people in the show. I know. And we did a whole 2-hour concert for four people. It was very strange, and it was a totally different vibe, obviously, because the audience, the audience and the band were the same size.
Well, yeah. We did one, Jenny, where we played at Mike Delaney's house. It was an auction item.
Oh, that's right.
And there were five of us in the band, and there were six. There were three couples. That's true. There were three or four couples, and it was so beautiful. I mean, it was so intimate. They're sitting in the living room, and we're playing. You know,
they're
in
this close.
Yeah. And it was just palpable. I mean, we could really feel what they were feeling. Well, we could tell when we moved.
Many of them were saying it out loud. But you have to be, I think that that's also a thing with me, is that you have to be willing to give everything, to leave it all on the table, so to speak, for four people or for 4,000 people.
Yeah.
And in fact, sometimes when there's more people, you give something different. There's almost like a protective thing that goes up, and you can't share stuff like we're trying to share. There's 90 tickets for each concert, period. Not one more. Like, we can't get any more people in there. So part of it was that we chose the venue because we wanted that intimacy.
Yeah.
I don't want 1,500 people at the concert, or we would have done it at the Ellen. You know?
Yeah.
Where there's already a piano on the stage. Yeah.
The opportunity to watch that get moved in seems like one that would be valuable. I'm just, you know, thinking about the back entrance of the filler.
It's always fun. You know, the nice thing, the legs come off and the thing goes up sideways and it's pretty skinny.
Yeah.
You know, and so you can get it in there.
It in there,
it's not a 9 foot, it's a 6 foot. So
yeah.
I'm wondering if there's going to be a lake out back that day.
Oh, man. Or inside.
Anything could happen.
Or inside. Good point.
We did a benefit show for KGVM at the filler, and it was in November, I think. And it started snowing that day, and man, it was snowing like crazy. And inside, I still don't quite understand exactly what happened, but it was snowing on the stage. That water was condensing and crystallizing, and it was snowing on the stage, and the musicians were like, kind of, you know, your initial reaction is disbelief or something, but it turned into this kind of cool thing. It's like, you know, it was just a different thing. So, you know, sometimes things at the filler
break into White Christmas.
Exactly.
Yeah. We should prepare our Christmas tune just for that.
That would be hysterical. Be the first ones to play it this year.
Oh, please God, don't snow inside the filler. Don't snow on September 27th.
Yeah. Chances that are probably, you know, it's Montana, so it's not out of the question, but pretty far.
I remember playing at Pine Creek one time when the creek was a little high and water was going across the stage over the electric cords. Yeah, this could get a little...
This might be your last gig.
it'd be shocking.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
Oh, well, I'm sure we could go one for one on
crazy
bad gig
things.
Stories. Just sound. If we only just talked about the sound issues, I'm
diversity
sure we could.
Is the norm.
I remember playing at the Robin Hood Elks Club in Sherwood, Oregon, and it had an upright piano, and 29 keys in the middle of the piano did not work. And so I was Spider-Man all night long playing, and every once in a while I think, they got a what? Nope. Yeah, it's just like a fender of a truck, you know. And I was, yeah, it was very strange. I felt like Schroeder on mushrooms. It's like, you got to do what you got to do, right?
Yeah. But, make it work.
You got through it.
Well, just to remind people, the 27th of September, is that a Friday night?
It sure is.
Friday night. So down at the filling station, two shows, seven and nine.
And tickets are online. It's advanced tickets only. So go to brownpapertickets.com and search for my name or Eric. Or Johnny.
And we have no comps. I have because the next day is my 75th birthday, all of my offspring are coming to town to come to the concert. And they said, are you comping us in? I said, I'm buying you tickets. because it's expensive to put this on.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I think if we sell out both shows,
there won't be any space to put anybody
else. We won't owe anyone any money.
Exactly.
That's where we're at. It's a
break-even concert.
Yep. Yeah.
But it's a gift.
It is. This is the kind of performance that I am interested in.
Might as well acknowledge Bill Fry and the Fries for being willing to go with our vision, because they were all in right away. Like, oh, it's a great idea.
I'd
love to have you guys. So thank you, Bill and the Fries.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. And maybe this will lead to another in another location you own.
Maybe.
There may or may not be a conversation about that. We'll see.
Rooftop at the Hof.
Rooftop.
A rooftop Hof concert.
Piano on the roof of... No, I'm just kidding.
That would be a thing. I mean, just a bunch when of you when drunks you said that,
pushing it up,
the idea of even inside at the Hof is like, well, that would be even more of an abundance of atmosphere than the filling station, if that's possible. So,
for sure, but about a third of the people.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Once you enter the Bermuda Triangle, you may never come out.
Yeah.
Still, some people down there that may show up
that you haven't seen for years.
Yeah. It's going to be really fun. We hope a lot of people come down, and it really will be a unique, memorable gig.
Yes, please join us.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in today and chatting. And I think it's going to be amazing. And everything I think I've seen each of you together or individually involved in is always something that I enjoy. So the all of you together, I think, will be something else. So
thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
All right. Thanks to Jenny Fleming, Eric Funk, and John Sanders for coming into the KGVM studios to talk about their upcoming show. I'm going to finish up here with a song by the Jenny Fleming Acoustic Trio. This one's called If I Loved You.
Again, I would try to say all I'd want you to know. If I loved you, words wouldn't come in an easy way. In circles I'd go.
Thanks for tuning in to the Local Musician Spotlight here on KGVM Bozeman. Keep it tuned right here and have a great night, everyone.